Good afternoon. I am opening a meeting of the House Higher Education and Workforce Development Committee on Tuesday, February 7th, 2017. And the first item on today's agenda was a work session for the possible introduction of committee measures. But we have no LC drafts for introduction today, so we'll move right into public hearings for three bills listed on today's agenda. And I am opening a public hearing on House Bill 2312. Laura, would you please provide the committee with a summary of the bill?
Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes to the committee from the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. House Bill 2312 would update terms and references associated with the implementation of Federal Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. It changes the name of State Workforce Investment Board to State Workforce Development Board, directs Higher Education Coordinating Commission to perform functions previously performed by the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and it declares emergency effective on passage. This measure has no fiscal impact, no revenue impact, no amendments, and no subsequent committee referral.
Thank you. And we have... I'd like to invite Kyle Thomas, Higher Education Coordinating Committee, to come to the dais.
Good afternoon, Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Wisman, Vice Chair Alonso Leon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kyle Thomas. I'm the Legislative and Policy Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I will be very, very brief. My testimony is not any more extensive than that just provided by the analyst. This bill makes three changes to our state workforce statutes. The first change removes references to the Federal Workforce Investment Act and replaces them with references to the Federal Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act in recognition of the fact that the federal WIA has been supplanted by the new WIOA. Second is it changes the name of the State Workforce Investment Board to the State Workforce Development Board and changes references in state statutes from workforce investment to workforce development, recognizing changes in federal nomenclature. And third, it replaces references to the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development with references to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission in recognition of the fact that CCWD is now an office within the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. That is the extent of the effect of the legislation, and I'm happy to take any questions you may have.
And I trust the committee has read all 40-plus pages of this bill and, uh-huh. and
memorized
ready.
It.
And have your questions ready?
That's why I was late.
Okay. All right. That's good. Any questions of Kyle? Okay. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kyle, thanks for your riveting testimony. To those of us that have been around here a while and we're here for the formation of the HEC, how do you dispel any suspicions some folks may have that this is involves a bit of mission creep on the part of the HEC? Now that we have officially taken CCWD out of the way in terms of workforce and now the HEC is there, we're talking about no expansion of FTE, we're not talking about any expansion of mission and scope and so forth, it's just simply a semantical change?
Representative Reardon, Representative Johnson, that is correct. It is meant simply to recognize the fact that the director of the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, formerly the executive director of the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development prior to the higher education system reorganization, now is a director that reports to the executive director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So it is merely to effect a change that was already made by a previous legislature in the reorganization.
Yes. So what you're saying then is all the duties and functions of existing FTE will remain the same. This is just simply on paper and organizationally it'll be the HEC instead of CCWD.
Correct. Under this legislation, there is no change to the function, structure, or totality expanse of the office.
Thank you.
I believe those functional changes were made, was it one session or two sessions ago, whenever?
Well, in terms of the reorganization, it was two sessions ago.
Yeah. Okay. And Vice Chair Wisman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're not adding, there's no revenue or physical impact on it. We're not adding or subtracting people. There's no savings when we can moved that under HEC that we could eliminate some FTEs? Is that
Representative Wisnett correct? Under this legislation, there is not. It is simply conforming to the reorganization that took place.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Of course.
How many FTEs were involved?
Representative Wisnett, I do not know the number of FTEs related to the reorganization off the top of my head. I can certainly follow up with that information.
Someone from community colleges is not here. No.
But are you talking about the reorganization that was done 4 years ago and a change in FTEs at that time? Or?
Well, we've assumed a new mission, Mr. Chair. Thank you. They've assumed a new mission. So they got so many FTEs. Was that 4 years ago? Is this for this budget? Or what budget are we?
So, Representative Wisnett, my history, and you'll have to pardon me because I'm new to the position and new to the state of Oregon, is very limited. So I'm limited at this point to speaking on the status of the office as it exists today. I would.
We can talk offline.
We can certainly. We can provide you those numbers in writing.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
My understanding, and I hope, please correct me if I'm wrong, is this is just strictly a nomenclature change and no functional change at this point.
That is correct.
Okay. Rep. Hurd, did you have a question?
No. Oh. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Kyle, for your testimony. Any testimony from the audience? Seeing none, I'm closing a public hearing on House Bill 2312, and I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2312. And no amendments, correct?
That's correct.
And no fiscal impact, no revenue impact. I think we need a motion.
Chair Reardon, I move HB 2312 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
And
that it be placed on the consent calendar.
Okay. And just a reminder for new members, if it's on a consent agenda, then we don't get to hear great introductions, large discussion on the floor. It just goes on the consent calendar and it passes without any discussion, which seems appropriate for this bill. So. Rep. Alonzo Leon moves the House Bill 2312 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and it will be placed on the consent agenda. Is there a discussion?
Mr. Chair, may I just suggest that, you know, there is also a tradition of having freshmen carry their first bill on the floor, that maybe this might be an appropriate vehicle for that to occur with one of our members.
Well, as always, Rep. Johnson, I do appreciate your suggestions, but if this one's not going to be talked about, we're going to miss that opportunity. But we do have an opportunity coming up later in this very same hearing. So please don't let me forget that. All right. Okay. No discussion. Do a roll call?
Yeah, if you
want. Okay. There's no dissent.
Do we need, what's the option? Okay. Okay, any further discussion? No. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, and I'll probably just do that on every bill.
Representative Bynum?
Aye.
Representative Clem?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Reschke?
Aye.
Representative Solomon?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lanzillon?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wizard?
Aye.
Chair Reardon?
Aye. Great. The motion passes.
Good
our
job.
First, our
Good
first
job.
Bill.
Good job.
Here.
Okay.
I'm such an old timer.
Okay. See you. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2314. Laura, please provide the committee with a brief summary of the bill.
Chair, members of the committee, this bill also comes to the committee from the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. House Bill 2314 would allow Higher Education Coordinating Commission to set minimum standards for graduation from cosmetology schools by rule. It requires HEC to approve public university mission statements and apprenticeship training credits, expands Aspire program financial aid and post-secondary options instruction to middle school and college students, authorizes the HEC to enter into contracts and agreements with public and private entities for certain higher education workforce development activities, directs the HEC to transfer interest earning monies from Oregon Student Assistance Fund to the Oregon Community Foundation for investment, updates statutory references to general educational development test, and replaces executive director title with director for HEC Office of Student Access and Completion. There is a dash one amendment that declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you. I think we have Kyle up again. Do you have a copy of it, Dan?
Yeah. Thank you again, Chair Reardon and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Kyle Thomas, Director of Legislative and Policy Affairs for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. The legislation you have in front of you right now makes six changes to state higher education statutes, and I'll briefly describe them in order. The first change in the legislation, Section 1, removes cosmetology hourly training standards from the state statutes. So this change would allow the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to adopt state standards related to cosmetology schools and instructional requirements for cosmetology licensure by rule. The idea is that through this change, which mirrors instructional hour changes that occur elsewhere in other fields that are licensed by other Oregon agencies, that changes due to changes in safety requirements, changes in technology, changes requested by employers, are changes that can be made in a more regular, ongoing, and nimble fashion by the HEC, which has ongoing relationships with the health licensing agency, with institutions, with providers out in the field, as opposed to the process of coming through and seeking those changes through a legislative process, which could be potentially less reactive based on the legislative timelines to changes in the field. I understand that there has been a little bit of a question that has arisen today as to whether or not this change and whether or not the rulemaking process that the HEC will undergo appropriately respects the difference between institutions that adopt or that provide instructional hours-based training and institutions that provide proficiency-based training. And so I'll just elaborate on that for a brief moment. Under the proposed change, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission will retain the authority to adopt rules that recognize the contributions of both categories of providers. So the current draft rules that the HEC is examining with a work group of both instructional hours-based schools and proficiency-based schools will both elaborate in our rules specific instructional hour requirements as well as specific proficiencies that a school is required to provide a student and instructional hour equivalencies for those proficiencies. So we believe under the current language that we have proposed before you that both instructional hour institutions and proficiency-based institutions and their role in providing students with education that leads to licensure in these fields is provided for and is respected. I'll move to the next section of the bill. Section 2 makes language in 350-085 consistent with other parts of the statute that already require the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to approve university missions. So this language changes the word review to the word approve.
Excuse me. Reper?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Can you entertain questions as we go, or would you rather wait till the end?
I'm happy to entertain questions as the committee desires.
Is that okay?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you. So hitting on that concern that arose today, and I'm just looking for clarification. So the concern that was relayed to me, and I haven't been able to quite track it down in the 45 pages, but was that there's these private schools, if I understand it correctly, that when a citizen migrates from, say, New York State or California State and was licensed there to do any of the different industries or professions talked about in this bill, they took a proficiency test at some of these private institutions, and then once it was deemed that they were adequate in their knowledge and whatnot, they then received their license in Oregon. You're saying that that will continue, that that we won't be doing away with that, and then requiring the 1,450-hour?
So that, Representative Reardon, Representative Hurd, that is a slightly different issue than the one that I just described. Currently, under current law, and as it would exist under the proposal, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission delegates to certain institutions the responsibility to essentially screen students or prospective licensees that wish to sit for the state licensing exam who may be from out of state or who may be from out of country. There is criteria that is currently in place for a school to become one of those delegates to screen students for their appropriateness in sitting for the state licensure examination. That process does not change under the proposed legislation. That is separate from the proficiency-based instruction that is would be codified under the new rules.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. Oh, Rick Johnson.
Thank you. While we're on the same topic, you mentioned current language. The only current language I see in here is set, I mean, in terms of the current language made available to us that you're asking for, all I see is referring to shall be set by the commission by rule. I don't see a lot of flesh on the bones there, and I think the what's in question and what arouses some concerns on the part of some is what will that rule ultimately entail? I guess my question would be, is it possible to put a little more clarity around this before we actually would actually adopt the bill or move the bill forward? Is there a pressing time concern here? Is there an emergency clause in play? I know you wanted to add one in here, but I think that's part of it. Not that people don't trust what's going to happen, but they just would like to see that there is both a traditional pathway as well as a proficiency pathway for these various career colleges and so forth, and that some folks, some programs are not going to, are going to have a very difficult time, you know, moving students through if, you know, they just don't know what the final product's going to look like.
Representative Reardon, Representative Johnson, the Dash 1 Amendment and the Emergency Clause is intended to allow HEC to adopt rules sooner rather than later, because it is expected that those rules may reduce the amount of instructional hours required. And so the thinking there is the sooner that we could effect a change in those standards, the sooner we are able to save students time, money, the possibility of taking on debt in pursuing this particular credential. As it relates to your other question, we are working with within a work group of 16 institutions, six of which are these proficiency or competency-based institutions. And the rules that the HEC is considering adopting are being vetted through that work group. I do not have a set of rules in front of me today to share with you, but the urgency around the legislation and the emergency clause is related to the idea that the sooner a rule change does happen, the sooner that instructional hour requirements are potentially reduced.
Follow up, yeah, sure. I wonder if we might be able to just add a little more focus to what the rules, what the ultimate outcome of the rules would look like, just in language, so that it might be there to alleviate some of the concern on the part of folks. You know, it could be a pretty easy amendment to actually apply into the bill.
Yeah.
Just so the work of that 16 stakeholder work group would be focused and targeted toward a specific outcome.
Representative Johnson, certainly I think we'd be amenable to that.
Thank you.
And the process of putting instructional hour requirements in rule more aligns with the current state of play. Yeah. These are the this is actually a unique situation that instructional hour requirements are in statute as it pertains to the HECS responsibility. I recognize that they exist in other parts of state law.
I don't think we'd want to advocate for specific hours, just that hours and or proficiencies would all be a part of the mix. Differing pathways. So
great. Thanks. Okay. Thank you. Oh, is there more?
Oh, certainly.
All right.
Five more.
Under current law, the HEC approves university mission statements, and Section 2 clarifies the fact that that is the activity that the HEC currently undertakes. So it replaces the word review with the word approve, which already exists elsewhere in state statute. Sections 3 through 5 correct references to the State Board of Education, recognizing that it's the HEC that now oversees the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development and not the State Board of Education. Section 6 modifies language around the Aspire program. The Aspire program is a program that provides mentorship opportunities for first-generation college students, low-income college students, beginning as early as middle school. And the changes you see recognize the breadth of activity that Aspire undertakes. Section 7 through 9 clean up the fact that when HEC as an agency was established, it lacked certain authorities related to the ability to do procurement. Nothing in Section 7 through 9 expands HEC's authority to engage in procurement for activities it's not otherwise authorized to engage in other sections of the law. It merely ensures that for those activities we are authorized to engage in, we have the appropriate contracting and procurement authorities that other state agencies do. This simply puts us on a level playing field with every other state agency, and it's really a cleanup related to items that were essentially missed during the higher education reorganization. The next change changes the title of the head of the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development from executive director to director, as we've previously discussed. Sections 11 through 13 transfer to the Oregon Community Foundation $900,000 that's currently housed with the state treasurer. And the reason for transferring those funds is to allow the Community College Foundation to invest them. They're the corpus of a scholarship fund, and it would allow those investments to gain appropriate returns that are more in line with the goals of the fund, the timeline for which the fund is expected to exist, and the associated risk that the fund can undertake. Ideally, this transfer from the Treasury to OCF would generate increased interest that could be then put into additional scholarship opportunities for students. And the final change is to recognize that the general equivalency degree is actually a trademark that doesn't represent the new options that are becoming available for students in pursuit of high school equivalency. And there are actually a couple of other examinations by a couple of other educational testing service providers that are gaining greater acceptance across the country. This does not authorize those tests to begin to be used in the state of Oregon, but does begin to clear the way for the use of those tests if it is later deemed appropriate by making the language around GED more generic language in our statutes. And that is the extent of the bill, and I'm happy to entertain questions.
Just a quick comment, Kyle. GED stands for General Education Development, not degree. Just want to clear that up, but it's not a degree. It's a certificate, actually. And then just because I worked for the HEC and was a GED administrator, changing, referencing the GED test, because it's a test, to high school equivalency.
Thank you. Any other comments? Yeah. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kyle, I missed sections 4 and 5 regarding apprenticeship training and so forth, and substituting the HEC for the state board. What's the rationale or the need for that?
Representative Johnson, the rationale is similar to the rationale that we discussed in the previous legislation, and that is through the process of reorganization that has already been undertaken, it is the HEC that currently supervises that activity.
Okay. Thank you.
Rep. Reschke.
Thank you for coming. My question is, when you change something, there's usually harm being done, and you're changing it to provide a new benefit. And so I'm trying to grasp, put my hands around what's the harm currently being done, the way things are currently being done, and what's the true benefit for students as far as consumers, just general Oregonians, not necessarily does it benefit the HEC. So.
Representative Reschke, in this particular situation as it relates to this legislation, by and large, the majority of changes you see here are not related to harm or correcting that harm. They are opportunities to go back into the statutes and ensure that the language of the current statutes reflect activities that have already been authorized by previous legislative action that through the process of creating and authoring statutes was not as clear or perhaps is even confusing, not as clear as it should be. So generally that is the changes those are the changes that you see in front of you.
Okay. Are there any questions? Anyone from the public? Well, we do have people from the public. Kyle, I think you're done for now. Thank you. And if people that are, we have two people that would like to testify, and if you'd like to come up together, that would be great. Appreciate it. Welcome to our committee. Glad to have you here. And I'll just, I think your first time testifiers, perhaps, or so if you would be about a foot from the microphone, so they're very sensitive, that would be helpful. And then just introduce yourselves and for the record, and either of you can go first.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair Reardon and committee members. My name is Meteen Kent. I'm business owner of Portland Beauty School. Our school is the proficiency-based training. We also have students that go through the full completed clock hours as well. But our school helps many individuals that have had prior training from other states or other countries that has a challenge with transcripts from these other countries or states. And we help administer a very vigorous testing in our school, 8-hour practical exam, 6 hours of written exams before they are able to pass. And we help them get prepared for state licensing exams. So we're here today because Kyle had already mentioned the difference between the two models of schools. The minimum hourly training facilities average tuition is $12,000 to $25,000. And a majority of these schools, regardless of whether students have prior training or not, it doesn't matter. These individuals have to start from the beginning and pay the full tuition. And most of these individuals have been working in the workforce for years and years and have excellent work history. So our proficiency-based training program helps these individuals get into the workforce immediately. And our average cost is $2,000 to give them a skills assessment and get them licensed and legally working in the salon. The fact is that the industry that we're in, many of these people are in the salons working under the table, working cash and not having a license. We have a prime example. A couple months ago, we had 8 individuals come into our school that same day, was fined from a salon for working illegally. And they had been doing this for 10, 15 years. And they did not know that our program existed. And when they found out and they came in and enrolled, they went through our vigorous testing, passed all of the tests with flying colors, and now is preparing to go to the state exam and take their test and get their license, and being having a license and working and becoming a taxpayer. So that's why we're here to our thoughts with the House Bill 2314. We're proposing that you consider, rather than removing it, just to adjust it to accomplish the goal of flexibility while still protecting and regulating proficiency-based models. Proficiency-based schools have a history of being misunderstood. And if you see Exhibit B, it shows an example of a meeting. It was a advisory meeting with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission and health licensing and school owners. And the meeting was about a transcript that an individual came from the state of Utah showing 8 hours. And they were questioning the validity of the transcript. And for some divine reason, I happened to have the transcript in my hand that day and the whole student file. And the state agencies were questioning the validity of that transcript, thinking that our school was doing something fraudulent. How could a hair design person who normally would have to go through 1,450 hours in the state of Oregon now in this transcript shows only 8 hours? And they said, that's impossible. This must be fraudulent. Not ever did we receive one phone call or email from either agencies to question that transcript. It could have been resolved within 5 minutes. We then had to speak about this transcript, and I stated that this individual had a license in Utah, went through her training, had 1,600 hours, more than what Oregon even has, and that individual had a license and let it lapse because she wasn't active, and it lapsed. So when it was time for her to move to Oregon to try to get Oregon's license, she could not get a license because she didn't have a transcript. Well, she went back to the school, but the school went out of business. So she couldn't get the transcript from the school. The state licensing in Utah did not have records. So our program allowed her to go through the skills assessment test and get a license. She immediately, within 2 weeks, she went through our test, passed with flying colors, within 2 weeks went to health licensing, got her license, and was in the workforce. So that's why we're here today. We know that there's a lot of misunderstanding between the two programs, and we just are hoping that you don't delete it from the law because it will no longer protect our school. We have, this is our 20-year anniversary being in business, and we have been battling with these type of issues. Yes. You want to speak? Oh, okay. Our school just provides an alternative path for thousands of people working under the table in those transitioning careers. Go ahead. Yeah, okay. I lost my thoughts. Sorry. Okay.
Sorry. So you're doing great.
Thank you. Very helpful. So, Representative or Chair Reardon, my name and the committee. My name is Michelle Larson. I'm a business consultant for Meetian. And I just first want to say she's done an excellent job at speaking to why these proficiency schools are very important. And I also want to thank Kyle and Representative Johnson, who have already also spoken to some of the proposed changes to the law. And we appreciate that there does need to be some changes that do simplify that process that he spoke to. We think that is that we support that. What Meetian is speaking to today is she's highlighted a little bit of the problems that they've faced and some of the maybe feeling like perhaps they're kind of have some battles in their legitimacy. So she fears that if you completely take that language out of the bill that already exists in there, speaking to proficiency-based model schools, that makes that battle that she feels they're already facing even harder. So if you turn to Exhibit A, we've given you some materials. I think, do you have those there? Great. So in Exhibit A, we just have highlighted how the current law reads in this particular section that we're speaking to. So the current law does read and show the minimum with a lot of language, which it sounds like in other areas, it doesn't have this lengthy language with very descriptive hours, which Kyle was speaking to, which we support that is changed. The piece that we ask is that B, the line B, stays as is. It's the only place in any of the bills that we could find that even speaks to proficiency-based schools. So if this is omitted from this, we don't have this legal, it's not anywhere written in a legal basis that shows that these are, she's spoken to how important they are, and so this, we feel that this is important for these schools to have that language in a bill. So the second one, proposed House Bill 2314, shows what that language would look like if you accept the proposed changes. What we're asking is that perhaps you consider a third option, that and we've just put one in there that maybe would be one that you could consider or that you could discuss and come up with something similar, but something that does keep the language that speaks to the proficiency-based model. So that's what we're asking today, is that if this is changed, that you consider to keep that language in there.
This is a good day for her.
Sorry. Big day. We appreciate your consideration of that, Chair Reardon and the committee. Thank you.
Okay, great. Any questions or comments?
Yes.
Rep. Bonner?
Thank you so much for testifying. I really appreciate the courage to come up and talk about your business. I'm a small business owner as well, so I 100% understand this. And hopefully I can articulate my thoughts well. So first of all, I support women and minorities being able to enter the workforce with the least amount of barriers possible. I want to make sure that, as a second point, that we increase the number of service providers that can perform these very important responsibilities in the community, especially for women of color. So, for instance, if I'm with Nike or Intel and I'm coming to Oregon to look at living here, I'm going to look for a couple of things. Where can I live and where can I get my hair done? And right now, and I'm dead serious. And so,
Rep. Clem and I agree. Yeah, exactly.
So as it is right now, for instance, so I live in Happy Valley, but I travel a good, I don't know, 30 minutes to go find someone that can do my hair. For my sons and my husband, it's a 45-minute trip. They're not enough providers. And so when you look at people who want to maybe move back to Oregon because maybe they grew up here, or they are moving here because they've relocated with a spouse and they have proficiency in doing African American hair. Right now we have barriers, and Oregon does not teach how to do our hair, quite frankly, or how to care for us in that way. And so making sure that we have the lowest number of barriers to people being able to transfer their licenses here without starting over in school is a concern for me. And so I want to have an additional opportunity to look at the language to make sure that being absorbed into the HEC doesn't prevent women from working, doesn't prevent me from being able to find qualified people, because we have a shortage as it is. So...
Thank you.
Statement.
Thank you. Other comments? I really appreciate what I've learned today and the different perspectives from everyone. And I'd really like to hear from Rep. Reschke.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chair. So to summarize your testimonies, you believe 2314 introduces uncertainty in proficiency-based schools. Is that, if we were to bottom line it, that's what you're worried about? It's uncertainty because rules haven't been made yet. It's put in the authority of the HEC, and you don't know what they're going to do with that. So you hope it turns out well for your business, but you do not know.
That way.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chair. So I really appreciate your testimony, so both of you. And I like that you came up with a potential solution. That doesn't often happen. And you presented something. Have you and the HEC sat down to talk about your potential solution? Did you guys discuss this as an opportunity?
No. Okay, how do I say this? Oftentimes when HEC or the health licensing agency wants to form a committee or discuss any changes in our cosmetology industry, oftentimes the competency-based schools are not always, I'm sorry, proficiency-based schools are not always invited to these things. We always hear after the changes have been made or last minute. There's 40 cosmetology schools in the state of Oregon, and there's only 6 proficiency-based schools. The rest are all clock hours. So the challenge that we face is, again, is that the proficiency-based schools are very misunderstood. People don't understand what we're about. So instead of calling us and just clarifying and understanding, people just assume that we're doing something wrong. And that's what we have been working with for 20 years. So we're trying to do our best. Our business is all word of mouth, all based on our graduates. We don't do any advertising. So if we're doing something wrong, if we're graduating students into the workforce and they are failing and they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, we would not be in business for 20 years. So I thank you all for asking the questions and hearing my testimony. Thank you.
I just have one additional question that keeps popping in my mind, and it has to do with the testing itself and how is that designed. And you have 6 different schools that are doing some proficiency testing. Is there a commonality between the schools, and could you tell us just a little bit about that process?
Sure. There is a state standard practical exam, and our school actually goes beyond the requirement of what the state has for that practical exam, as well as the state actually, for people who have prior training, can come into the school and just take that practical exam. We take it a step further, and we require them to do all of the written exams, which is not required by the state. But okay, we do that to prepare them for that state exam.
Okay. And I'm sorry, one other question. Then, do most of the people that get their license then go to work for themselves or work for somebody else?
Both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rep. Shulman?
I'm curious about, so I get the proficiency part of it and being able to show your skill level, but what about on the levels of the safety issues and the different, you know,
safety
restrictions that are put into place and the training that's required? So how is that covered? If they're showing the proficiency part of their skill, how do they learn about and go through the training for the safety?
Yes, thank you very much, Rep, for asking that question. All our exams cover all of those things. When they're doing their practical exam, they are also being graded on their safety sanitation, so how they are disinfecting their implements, how are they draping their client, how are they keeping everything clean and safe for the public, as well as we give an Oregon law written exam, career development, and then whether they're taking a hair, nails, or aesthetics licensing. So we give them all of those written exams as well. So they cannot leave our school until they have passed the exam.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well,
I thank you. Oh, sorry.
Just a brief question, Mr. Chair. We heard earlier that there's a 16-member stakeholder group working with the HEC to revise, to put these rules in place and so forth. Are you aware of who they may be, and do you feel like your business model is represented within that stakeholder group?
Thank you for your question. I at one point, you probably saw maybe in the letter from Representative Barbara Smith Warner, who wrote a letter on our behalf. I wanted to get on the board, on the HEC board, so that we could have a voice as a proficiency-based school. Currently, there are, I believe, a couple of school owners that are clock hour, the clock hour program. I'm still trying to get on the board, whether it be one of the boards, so that we do have a voice. But there's been some challenges with other issues that make it a challenge for me to get to that point.
Okay, well, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Appreciate that. And we have a late request. Could Kimberly Better please come up? We'd like to make some brief testimony. And if you would introduce yourself and for the record.
Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Wisenut, and Vice Chair Leon, and members of the committee. My name is Kimberly Bedore, and I'm the owner and executive director of Bella Institute School of Cosmetology. We are a proficiency-based school as well. My background is public education. I was a school principal, both middle school and high school, and I served on at the district level in school improvement. I'm extremely familiar with proficiency-based education, and even the thought that in public education there is a change push towards standard rather than hour-based instruction. I purchased IBS School of Cosmetology, which had been in existence since 2001. This school's existed now 16 years. It became Bella Institute School of Cosmetology 6 years ago. Our school is a bit different than Portland Beauty School. Our primary students are career changers. We have a few people that come to us. For example, yesterday, a very well-trained woman from Denmark came to our school, and she's wanting to go through the assessment program. I would say 98% of everyone who comes to Bella Institute is a traditional student. They come from careers. Our favorite career changers are nurses and bankers. We also have a wide number of people from the service industry. We have Latino students. We have, in Oregon, we have a large number of Caucasian students. We've had students of Asian, Vietnamese who had language problems and language problems from Russia. So we're not unfamiliar with dealing with students who have learning challenges. Our school, if everyone wanted to investigate it, we have one of the highest graduation rate, highest licensure rate, and some of the highest scores of passing scores at Oregon Health Licensing for licensure. We use a education very similar to my TENS as we teach to standard, not time. We teach the entire Miladies course book, and in some cases requiring even additional service requirements than what is standard for the state of Oregon. Our students within all of that generally graduate in about half the time of traditional hourly-based schools. We have a very efficient model. We serve a need in the public for women reentering the workforce. We have a lot of women that our school is out at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we don't go to school on Saturdays. So it meets women who are trying to reenter the workforce and those who are unable to go to cosmetology school without having a job. Our students in general are very traditional. And I want to represent proficiency-based not only as a more sensible way of learning. It's you learn and progress as you're able to attain the skill and as fast as we can logically present the material in each class. So to protect competency-based education, proficiency-based education is extremely important to have the choice for the public. And also as a representative Bynum, yes. Bynum mentions, is that there is a severe shortage of hairstylists, especially in the community. We cannot meet the needs of all of our employers who want to hire our students. Encouraging students of all ethnic backgrounds to come in and to be able to serve a growing, diverse Oregon. And we believe that proficiency-based deserves to be protected within the law. I read through all of the legislation yesterday, and there is almost nothing that mentions proficiency-based education outside of this particular bill. And we are very, very concerned to be able to maintain that choice for Oregonians.
Thank you for testimony. Rep. Bynum.
If I can offer some additional words to confirm what you're saying. So for me as a, 12-year-old, I braided all my neighbor's hair. And so that's not something you necessarily, many African-American women don't learn that in beauty school. You learn that as a child. Mm-hmm. And so so to require someone to do something perhaps that they've done all their life in order to be employed, I think, is what I would challenge. And so, you know, I just wanted to offer that as an additional piece of data in support of proficiency-based programs.
And I totally support proficiency education, by the way. I'm a former shop teacher, and it's more important for that they know how to operate the equipment safely than it is. I don't care how long it takes them to get there. So, mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for testifying. Appreciate that. And let's see where we are. We're done. We are
good. That's really nice.
Okay. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2314. And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2399. Laura, if you could please provide the committee with a brief summary.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2399 would establish the Condon Collection at the University of Oregon's Museum of Natural and Cultural History as the official depository for paleontological materials that may come into the possession of the state of Oregon. The measure has no fiscal impact, no revenue impact, no amendments, and no subsequent committee referral.
Okay, and do I see? Okay, I don't see Rep. Fahey. She is. Here. If Rep. Fahey and Dr. Rudelick, you could join us. I'm not sure I pronounced that correctly, but
rhymes with metallic.
Well, I think I did pretty well then. So, if you guys, either one can go first, and if you would introduce yourself, we'd appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Julie Fahey, and I'm the state representative from House District 14, which is West Eugene and Junction City. House Bill 2399 would establish the Condon Collection at the University of Oregon's Museum of Natural and Cultural History as Oregon's State Museum of Paleontology. The UO's Museum of Natural and Cultural History is our state's primary repository for publicly owned collections. In 1935, it was established by the legislature as the Oregon State Museum of Anthropology. The museum is accredited by the American Alliance of Museums, distinguishing it as one of the very best in the nation. This museum and all of its collections enhance our knowledge of Earth's environment and cultures, inspiring stewardship of Oregon's collective past, present, and future. The Condon Collection is named after Thomas Condon, who was one of the first three professors at the university. He brought to the university an extensive collection of fossils, which was later named in his honor. By making this designation, we hope to make Oregon more competitive in attracting special items and collections of scientific interest, and to aid in fundraising for the museum's endowment. 24 other states have designated such paleontology museums. And with that, I would like to introduce Dr. Greg Ritalik, who is the director of the Condon Collection at the U of O. He'll provide the committee with some more details and background, and you can he can answer any questions about the museum that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fahey. Chair Reardon, members of the committee, I'm here in support of House Bill 2399. You've probably heard quite a bit about our museum in recent years because we're making quite a splash with publicity, with lectures, and with banquets, and we now have an educational program that's reached every county in the state of Oregon. We're now a million-dollar operation with 50 employees, believe it or not, and we seem to be having more and more support. But this bill is not about that so much as about the research side of our enterprise, and I'm the director of the Condon Collection, which is a scientific collection of priceless fossils from the state of Oregon. Priceless in the sense that we'll never get another one. These are, in many cases, the name bearers for the particular species that we have here in Oregon. The database is now online. About 40,000 specimens are online. You can check it out at paleo.uoregon.edu. And that's about half the collection. We have work study students and others busily entering material. So if you want to find out about a fossil in Oregon, a locality, or a species, or anything about our fossils, you can actually look it up. And many of them are supported by pictures, which is becoming pretty time-consuming, but we're on it. The main idea of this bill is to safeguard the material which we bought from Thomas Condon in 1907. The state bought that to the university. These are priceless specimens which we want to keep in perpetuity. The main problem that we have with these sorts of collections is that without being the official collection of the state of Oregon, like the Anthropology Museum, is we're losing specimens that we could otherwise attract. Specimens from private collectors, such as the NAG Club of Amateurs from Hillsborough. Specimens from people who collect fossils on the coast, like Doug Emlon, deceased some years ago, and the Gibson Collection, which both went to the Smithsonian instead of the state of Oregon, where we think they would be better served the people of Oregon and both our education and our research mission. We're quite famous for fossils and rock hounds, and this is quite an interesting time to be a director of a collection because a lot of those old rock shops are going out of business. A lot of those old rock hounds are going to the great rock hunting sky, fields in the sky, we are actually getting quite inundated with really quite important specimens. For a specimen to come into our collection, it not only has to be signed off legally by the owner of the specimen, but it has to be signed off by us as an acceptable within our own collection scope. We have all this paperwork according to state rules, and being the State Museum of Paleontology, I think will give us a little more authority to do what we do. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Questions? Rep. Reschke.
Thank you for coming, both of you. There's no fiscal impact at all. So there will be no additional employees needed, no additional space needed, none of that.
No additional fiscal impact. We're trying to grow, of course, but that doesn't come from state money. We're funded by a combination of donations. Our endowment is now almost $10 million, as Bev hinted, and we're mainly funded through the University of Oregon through our educational mission.
Thank you.
We do think this designation will help the perpetuity part of our contract with the state, that if the university wants to get rid of the fossils, they can't. So we're very interested in that aspect of it from a legal point of view as well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sorry.
Just wanted to make a quick comment. I'm from Woodburn, and it sounds like a lot of the specimens came from the Woodburn area.
There are indeed. We actually have a memorandum of understanding with the city of Woodburn, as you probably know,
yes.
Wherein they have legal title to the fossils that come out of Woodburn area. Woodburn is fabulous for megafauna, and we house it for them. And if they in the future want to mount a bigger display or something, well, we'll turn them over because they have legal title to them. We also have similar arrangements with the Bureau of Land Management and with the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries in Portland. They had collections, and this kind of legal memorandum of understanding business is working to, I think, everybody's benefit, because when state agencies downsize, things have to go, but they still need to be cared for. It's working especially to our benefit because the Bureau of Land Management now recognizes that a huge collection of fossils from Fossil Lake out in the Christmas Valley area of Central Oregon, again, megafauna like the Woodburn material from the South Dakota School of Mines, may be repatriated to us in Oregon. So, yes, we're very invested in working with other agencies in government.
Thank you.
Representative Shulman.
Thank you, Chair. I was just wondering, having this more into a centralized area, does this have great effects on the education, for K-12 to be able to?
Absolutely. We have separate education and research wings, and having excess collections helps us to stock our teaching collections, of course, because we use some of the material which is not of scientific value for that purpose. But the main purpose of this bill is to aggregate a research collection. And since we have the catalog online, we're finding an increased traffic of scientists from all around the world coming to Eugene to look at our specimens, because we have a limited loan policy. Many of these specimens do not travel well, and we don't want them to leave our climate-controlled, insect-controlled special vault.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Great. Very good. Anything else from you? I have to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Could you define paleontology? The time period that we're talking about?
Oh, paleontology, yes. Has to do with fossils, and it's generally material that's older than 10,000 years.
Okay.
That's how it's commonly defined. So our collection is actually goes quite deep in time. I personally have been working on rocks in Western Australia that are 3.5 billion years old, and we have a rather unique collection of those. We have a lot of collections from 500 million years or so all around the world, particularly in Australia, which is where my research has specialized. But the bulk of the collection is the historic Conan collection and a lot of material from Oregon, priceless material of fossil mammals going back about 60 million years. And if you're interested further, we have a beautiful new exhibit that opened just 2 years ago called Explore Oregon, which I do recommend. It's a major new museum and exhibit, and we also renovated our anthropology exhibit. So we're looking like a fun place to visit right now.
Nice.
Well, I'm excited about visiting now, so thank you for your testimony.
Do consider our banquet. We have a wonderful banquet every year, which is absolutely wonderful, with a natural history speaker and too much wine.
Interesting menu, I'm sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are the sandals from Fort Rock, or do you have those?
We don't. They're in the Museum of Anthropology, which is the State Museum of Anthropology, and they're in a special vault. But, yes, we have dozens of those. I'm the paleontology side, so this bill is really for the paleontologists to catch up with the anthropologists who had it all figured out in 1935.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anybody from the audience that wish to testify?
I don't want to discredit.
Seeing none, I am closing the public hearing on House Bill 2399, and I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2399. There are no amendments, no fiscal, no revenue impact. I would entertain a motion.
Chair Reardon, I move House Bill 2399 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Rep. Wisnett moves House Bill 2399 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Okay. If there's no further discussion, if we'd have a roll call vote.
Representative Bynum?
Aye.
Representative
Clem? Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Reschke?
Aye.
Representative Solman?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Lonzio?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair
Reardon? Sure, you can vote.
May I vote again?
Aye.
Ask Biden to read.
Oh.
So she's recorded.
Okay.
Ask Biden to repeat.
Rep. Bynum, if you could repeat your vote for the microphone, please.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. The motion passes. And we need a carrier, and I so much wanted somebody from this committee to carry that, but if we could ask Rep. Fahey to carry this bill, we'd be appreciated. Would that be all right? Okay. You've got it. Okay. Good job. And so we're closing. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2399, and I'm opening an informational hearing, overview of affordability and financial aid in Oregon. So consider that open. And I'd like to invite Ben Cannon, President Mark Matsui from Portland Community College, and Rex Fuller. Thank you for coming in today. Appreciate it. We're all keenly interested in affordability of, for our students and interested to hear what we have to say. So you can decide who goes first.
Thank you, Chair Reardon, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Oregon Higher Education Committee. I will kick it off and set some context with some slides and information. There are a number of them here. I won't go into great detail. Some I may even skip over in the interest of giving the presidents to my left an opportunity to contribute and provide really more texture about the affordability issues as they see them on their respective campuses. But I'll do some stage setting, and then we'll get on with the show. Please, as usual, feel free to stop me at any point with questions. So affordability in Oregon higher education, this has been an important theme for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission and for the public. How affordable is Oregon higher education? So let's just start with a question about how to measure this. And as I described to you last time, I won't go over this slide again, but it attempts to suggest that affordability is actually a multidimensional issue, and there's not a simple answer to the question of how affordable is Oregon higher education. Again, I won't go around the whole slide, but it's not just about tuition. These other elements contribute to our understanding of whether higher education is affordable or not. So how do we measure it? Well, tuition is a starting place, but it's not great. So I've indicated that's an okay way of thinking about and measuring affordability, but not particularly good. I'm going to go on and talk about, mention some of these others, measures, cost of attendance, net price to income, and other factors that aren't systematically quantified, and then look briefly at debt. But tuition and fees, I'll start there just with a little bit of history. This is our average community college tuition and fees in Oregon over the last 7 or 8 years. You can see that steady rise and pretty significant increase in that time period. When you adjust it for inflation, the line flattens a bit, but still a pretty steep increase. For context here, that third line, the bottom line, is the Oregon Opportunity Grant, a need-based aid program that we offer for students, and I'll come back to that in a few minutes. On the public university side, the increases have been even steeper over the same time period. Again, slight flattening when you adjust for inflation, and here's the average opportunity grant over that time period, which has not kept up with those tuition increases. Tuition, though, as I've noted, is not sufficient to understanding the costs associated with higher education. So we often talk about total cost of attendance, and that starts with tuition, but it includes mandatory fees, housing, food, transportation, supplies, and textbooks. I've just given an example. I'm sorry that Representative Clem left the room for this, but an example of one of those factors, textbooks. We did a survey, the HEC did a survey of thousands of students a couple of years ago that revealed the findings you see there, that almost 50% of students reported spending more than $250 in a single term on textbooks. This is clearly a growing driver in costs, and that's encompassed within this total cost of attendance figure. Question. Net price comes closer to being a accurate sort of measure of affordability because it takes that total cost of attendance and subtracts out grant aid, so Pell grants that the federal government administers, our state grants, institutional aid. It varies by students because, of course, students have different costs of attendance and they have different amount. They qualify for different amounts of grant aid, and it can be but it can be expressed as an average for the for a population or a student body as a whole. So now we're coming closer to a strong definition of affordability, but let's put it in the context of Oregon family income. So what this chart shows, and I'll spend just a moment on this because I think it's useful and important, even though the data is a couple of years out of date, is the percentage of family income on average that would be needed to attend college full-time at Oregon's higher education institutions. And we've classified them by different types. So your public 2 years or your community colleges. And in 2013, the typical family would have had to dedicate 22% of their income to pay the net price. So after qualifying for whatever grants and scholarships, they still would have dedicated 22% of their family income, or they would have had to work, the student or someone would have had to work 19 weeks at full-time minimum wage in order to afford community college. And you can see that rises for four-year schools and private schools, where at our public research universities, that's 34% of the family income. For lower-income families, that percentage of income, notwithstanding their greater qualification for grants, is actually even higher, and they're dedicating even greater percentages of their income to afford the cost of higher education, even after grants are figured in. Oregon, on that measure, net price as a percentage of income, does poorly in national comparisons. You can see the green states are ones that where that net price as a percentage of income is lower, down as low as 12% of the average family income. In certain states, the red, closer to red or orange, it's as high as 30%. Oregon is in the upper tier. You saw our ranking on the last slide, and again, the average of 22%. This is just for the two-year colleges. We have similar data for the four-year schools as well, but I haven't included it here. What about debt? A lot of attention, I think appropriately, to the question of what our students are graduating with. Students who graduate, which is not all, of course, but students who graduate from a four-year institution, public or private, in Oregon, are leaving with an average of almost $28,000 of debt, slightly below the national average of $30,000. Loan repayment. So this is now all students, and I won't go into all the details on the slide, but this is now all students who have taken a federal loan, whether they graduated or not, and it classifies how many of them are in repayment, meaning they've actually put a dollar or more in towards their principal, paying down their principal 3 years after leaving school. And this is actually national data, not Oregon data. But as you can see on the left-hand side, students who received a Pell Grant, meaning they're lower-income students, only 42% of those students have made at least a dollar towards repaying their principal 3 years after leaving schools. Higher for the higher-income students who weren't Pell Grant recipients. And then you can see the also on the right-hand chart here, students who didn't complete their degrees, not surprisingly, were less likely to begin repayment than students who had not completed. Student loan repayment is concentrated among those from higher-income backgrounds who complete their degrees. These slides, I'll just highlight a couple of points from them. I think that's great, interesting information that came out of a Wisconsin study last year surveying a whole lot of students around the country on their experience of affordability. This is about food insecurity, where 37% of students reported that they couldn't afford to eat balanced meals at some point. 37% said they had eaten less than they felt like they should have at some point during the last year because there wasn't enough money for food. Housing insecurity, 28% reported in the last year they were unable to pay their rent on time. Interestingly, because I think it may complicate or challenge the sort of traditional view of students as a 18, 19-year-old just coming right out of their parents' home, but 38% of college students today report giving money for food for their families. They're actually helping to support their families.
I think we have a question. Rep. Hurd? Sorry about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No problem. The page back on the student debt repayment rates. So forgive me for not being familiar enough with how those loans are structured. Are those folks, the 58%, say on the far left one, the 58% that have not paid the dollar or more in the 3 years, are they just paying interest only, or how is that working?
Representative Hurd, Chair Reardon, it would include students who are taking advantage of an interest-only option, and the federal government has created additional repayment options, including ones that allow students for periods of time to focus just on the interest. So it would include those students. It would include students who are in default for failing to make payments. It would include students who are at risk of being in default for being behind or not caught up on their payments. So yes, there would be a variety of categories of borrowers who would be in that classification.
Quick follow-up.
Sure.
What's the terms of the loans? Is that something that varies from student to student, or is it a general rule that they're 120 months, 72 months? How do they structure that payment schedule?
Representative Hurd, Chair Reardon, there are a variety of different lending options, federally designated lending options or borrowing options for students with different terms and different repayment possibilities. It's not unlike shopping for a mortgage in terms of its complexity. Mm-hmm. And we would be happy to come back to the committee to describe more about the options for student loan borrowing. This is focused just on the sort of borrowing from the federal government. So there's also a private borrowing market that adds even more complexity. So it is it's unfortunately not a simple answer. They tend, though, not to be short-term repayment periods. Most student borrowers are repaying over 10 years or more.
Okay, thank you.
This slide that I stopped on simply notes the extent to which students today are helping their families. I think that is something worth keeping in mind as we think through college affordability or unaffordability. So at this point in the presentation, I think it's worth stopping for a moment and saying, wow, is it worth it? And as a commission and as an agency, as we've looked at the data on this and thought about affordability in this multidimensional way, read the research, the answer is yes, it is worth it on average for students who earn degrees or certificates. That, in fact, the earnings benefits associated with greater levels of educational attainment on average, this is not true, obviously, in every individual case, but on average do justify greater levels of borrowing or greater levels of cost associated with higher education. But there are many students who don't complete, and this is reflected in the attention to completion that our institutions and the HEC are paying. So this chart merely sort of shows that relationship between, again, on average, this is the entire U.S. population, the level of education, and the likely or expected earnings.
Rep. Flausholm.
Just a quick question. Thank you, Chair. I was curious if there is something that maybe moving forward looking at. Do you look at where the degrees have, you know, where folks are getting their degrees and their line of work after that? So is there a, because a lot of times we can hear that there are students that have a college degree, but they didn't end up going into that line of work. So is there ever any
is that where does the doctor of psychology or actually go to work? Or
yeah, I mean, it can be, there's multiple. I mean, I don't care about necessarily specific, you know, but I'm curious if their degree ties into what they are doing.
Representative Solman, Chair Reardon, I suspect that our institutions, through their contact with alumni in particular, would be able to speak in part to that question of the connection between degree field, which I think is what you're mm-hmm. getting at, and the profession that they enter. We don't, as an organization and as a state, systematically mm-hmm. track that. We do have the opportunity to somewhat systematically draw connections between the earnings and the degree type, but not we have not taken that down to the level of what okay. field they're actually in.
Could you say that again? I think I understood what you said, but you're not tracking where the students go?
Chair Reardon, the HEC as a state agency does not track systematically what fields, employment categories, occupations our graduates enter. We do, through partnership with the Oregon Employment Department, have the ability on a sort of ad hoc basis to do some of that data matching. So there's a certain amount of opportunity in this respect, but we don't have that at our fingertips.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Yeah. Rep. Bynum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any, and this question can be for the whole panel, is there any institution that provides debt counseling to say that if a student is thinking about, I talked to a young man who wanted to go to a university and they had offered him $30,000 in aid, but it cost $60,000 to attend. Mm-hmm. He was excited about the $30,000, and it broke my heart to tell him that's not going to cut it. And he wanted to major in guitar. And so is there, are there any institutions that are doing a payback period for what you plan to major in and how much debt it's going to cost you if you come to my institution?
Representative Bynum, Chair Reardon, there is a movement in higher education around.
Excuse me. I need to ask you to introduce yourself for the record.
Yes. For the record, my name is Mark Mitsui. I'm the president of Portland Community College. There is, within higher education, a financial literacy movement, and there are a variety of different community colleges here in Oregon and around the country that do provide financial literacy education for students, including pre-loan counseling and the importance of understanding the terms. And there also are more data tools now. For example, the College Scorecard utilizes the Department of Education databases so that students can go on, they can enter the institution name, they can look at grad rates, they can look at the average earnings. I'm proud to say that Portland Community College, in a recent analysis by the Portland Business Journal, identified PCC as the top institution in the state for the return on investment based on the tuition relative to the earnings of graduates from the institution. So that data is out there. A lot of it has to do, of course, with helping students to navigate the data and learn how to find it and how to use it.
Refreshing.
I have a comment and then a question. The comment is, get that chart in front of every high school student in Oregon. Mm-hmm. Second, my question for Mr. Cannon, thank you for coming again, is do you have data or do you track data for people that don't go to four-year or two-year institutions, go to professional degrees like cosmetology or becoming a plumber or becoming an electrician?
Representative Reschke, Chair Reardon, I will follow up about what type of earnings data we have relative to those fields. Many of those students will get, or those certificate holders will get classified in the some college, no degree section here. But I think teasing out the ones who earned a certificate, such as cosmetology or a healthcare profession or other trades, it would be worthwhile.
My point is that we need to help instill the idea that schooling shouldn't end at 18, that people are better off whether they go into traditional school or into some sort of trade school is a much better path forward than not. Thank you.
Rep. Alonzo.
Thank you, Chair. I want to say I'm really excited to hear that there's financial literacy educational opportunities happening within our education systems, because I think it's really critical, particularly with our first generation population. And I'm wondering, just from personal experience, I think that when we talk about financial literacy, that it's a family that's learning, not just a student, right? Because a lot of first-generation students don't have the experience in learning how to manage their funding for school. And if their parents didn't go to school, then that means that the parents probably don't as well. So just food for thought that when we're talking about educating our students, educate the family as a whole, because that will really help the student be successful.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I will go out on a limb and say that there are precisely seven things that need to be done to deal with the issue of affordability. But I'm not going to speak to all seven of them because we don't have a lot of time. I will start with minimizing the need for tuition increases. And just to provide a little bit of the history and context, this is now Oregon specific. There's a lot on this chart. I have to apologize in advance for the intensity of some of these charts and graphs. But this one, really, the thing to focus on is the green and the brown and the shift between them. This is Oregon, and the green bars represent state appropriations per student going back over time, so 1990 on the left and 2015 on the right. The brown is tuition revenues. This is colleges in all of our public institutions. And you can see over the years, and it's been adjusted for inflation, and you can see over the years the way in which, while the total height of those bars has remained fairly steady, there have been ups and downs to be sure, the blend of tuition revenues versus state appropriations has changed dramatically. We've gone from being a state where higher education was primarily public higher education was primarily state funded, to a state where higher education is primarily tuition funded by students and their families. This actually also includes, I mentioned, the appropriations to colleges and universities. This incorporates our grant programs, our state public grant programs as well. The red line is enrollment. So you see the significant growth in student enrollment during that time period, especially since 2008. How do we do nationally on this same measure, sort of net tuition as a percentage of total educational revenue? Well, we're very high. The average in the U.S. is 46.5%, meaning in the across the country, 46.5% of total revenue comes from tuition. In Oregon, as you've seen from the last chart, it's a significant majority, 61.6%. Yeah.
Do we know what it would cost to even that out?
Representative Reardon, no. We could find out, though. I don't know that offhand.
Just curious what that budget ask would look like if we did that.
Absolutely. This, again, just one bullet from this slide, this sort of top bullet. In 2015, Oregon ranked 45th in terms of our state appropriations per student. $4,700 per student compared with almost $7,000 nationally. To be clear, we've made significant gains since that report came out. We'll get a new version, the updated annual report on state appropriations per FTE within the next couple of months, and expect to see that Oregon advances 5 or 10 places because of the major investments that were made in 2015 by the Oregon legislature. But that represented sort of a low water mark of higher ed funding in the state of Oregon. The only other topic that I'll cover out of these seven and then sort of let it go is just, so I mentioned, minimizing the need for tuition increases in part through increasing state investment, but also increasing grant aid, especially for the lowest income students. And so we operate, you've heard about it, the Oregon Opportunity Grant that is focused on those lowest income students. Produces, we believe, this is a data a few years old from the old Oregon University students, but it improves graduation rates by several percent for students who get it. But we're not able to serve many of the thousands of students who qualify. So in the most recent year, we served 30% of eligible students, meaning a great amount of the need here goes unfunded. We also operate a program that builds pathways from high school to college for all students, the Oregon Promise. And I guess my other claim, and the sort of final claim I'll make here, is that even while we focus state funding and state grant aid on Oregon's lowest income students, in the context of the significant, particularly in the context of the significant increases of tuition that are occurring at community colleges and universities, preserving a pathway for all Oregon families, an affordable pathway to at least that two-year certificate or degree, is important and creates an opportunity then for some of those students to transfer to a four-year institution with less debt and more opportunity. We served this year, this fall, 844 more students from the high school class of 2016 transitioning directly into community college. That number actually understates the total. That's the footnote than we had 2 years earlier. So we think this program is important and successful. Finally, you can look at the list yourself. We'll have other opportunities, I'm sure, to talk about other ways in which the state and our institutions can improve affordability through increasing grad rates, maximizing opportunities in high return fields, and supporting innovations that lower student costs, such as online textbooks and other open educational resources. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I just was going to ask that maybe moving forward or something, is there an opportunity to see where in the state of Oregon folks are taking advantage of the Oregon Promise and, you know, in the different counties to be able to get some information on that?
Representative Solman, Chair Rudin, we'd be happy to follow up with that information, both by college as well as by high school or county of origin.
Thanks.
Refreshki.
Mr. Cannon, mine's a comment, maybe a question. Thank you for your presentation. And just curious, we're talking about affordability, so that means the ability for students to pay, but that's also a function of cost, right? So we didn't hear anything today, and I hope we get to hear in the future what schools are doing to drive costs down or keep them to a minimum and increase, because that's a huge consideration. And I'd like to look at that side of the equation as well.
Representative Reschke, Chair Rudin, I would be happy, as I'm sure the institutions would as well, to describe that as well. It certainly falls under that banner of minimizing the need for tuition increases.
Yeah.
I described the strategy around increasing state investment. There's also the strategy that our institutions are engaged in of trying to lower the sort of cost basis at the campus level. And then this final bullet about supporting innovation, including through more affordable textbooks, is one of many that can be used to reduce student costs.
Thank you.
Ben, you know, just offhand, for the educational component of what a university or a community college does, what percentage of that budget is staff?
Classroom staff? Look to these gentlemen.
Just roughly.
Mr. Chair, for our institution, 84% plus of our operating budget goes to labor, and about 50% of our operating budget, actually a little bit more than that, is our instructional costs.
Thank you.
Do we have time for a quick
We have about 10 minutes left, so quick questions, if we could, with just short answers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the future, yeah, that actually part of what you just said about where the spending is. I'd like to know if we can get some information on where does Oregon rank as far as our community colleges and four-year universities on professors and whatnot, what they're paid on average versus other states in the U.S., if we can get our hands on that data, to just understand deeper where that cost driver is coming from, potentially.
Thank you so much, Chair. And I wanted to say that to follow up on Representative Reschke's comment, I think that it would be great for the committee to look into further things such as the partnership with the Hillsborough School District with our Career and College Pathways. We have both of these fine institutions that are part of our roundtable, constant group discussion on how we are moving our CTE programs, dual credit options for students. And I think that that would be great opportunity for other districts to see a strong model, to replicate across the state. So thank you.
Thank you for your comment. Yeah, okay. And we are running. Oops. Rep. Johnson.
Gee, thanks, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. I think I got about 3 points, maybe. I'll see if I can get them. Ben, I appreciated you labeling the Oregon Promise as, was it low cost or affordable? But you didn't say free, which is my point, which I'm glad you said that, because it was never designed to be free. It was always designed to be an affordable pathway. But secondly, along that same line, I've been disappointed to read some of the recent press coverage being critical of the demographic blend that's taken advantage of the Oregon Promise and not exactly mirroring our demographics in terms of high school graduates and stuff. And there's a number of reasons for that we could get into, but you know, just to make the point that Oregon Promise was never designed to be just to cater to one subsection of our student population, but to be available across the board, because as we all know, there are a lot of working poor, I'll call them, in Oregon, middle class families who make too much to qualify for Pell or other grant and aid programs that we have, but they can't access this So necessarily then, because they're not getting other aid, their awards will be higher, and that's just the way the math works out. And I'm happy to say that we're actually making a pathway for a lot of families to be able to provide for their kids in ways that they wouldn't otherwise. But I wanted to get back to the other financial literacy piece that we mentioned earlier and just point out that in the bill that we passed, first of all today, from the HEC, in Section 6 and 7 under the Aspire program in here, we're now expanding Aspire, the HEC, to work with middle schools and our college students, but one of the key components in here is a financial aid instruction component. So that is happening. So I just wanted to make that point that we passed something earlier today to ensure that we are providing financial literacy or financial aid counseling for students as they project their pathways forward. So.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Bill. So for those of you that haven't had a chance to look at any more than the bold and the italic changes, that really is a good overview of the system as it exists today. So I'm going to print a copy out for myself just for future reference. So I'll just point that out. So, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I don't know if I have to repeat for the record, but
you're good.
Are we good? Okay. I did want to say for the record, though, I'm glad to be back in the Pacific Northwest. I spent 3 years in Washington, D.C. as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Community Colleges at the U.S. Department of Education, and really happy to be back in the Northwest working within a great community college system for
you. Got out
community
just
college.
In time.
No comment. But thank you again for the opportunity to speak. And Ben has already touched on the student need and the unmet financial need of our students, and also the housing and food insecurity that our students have. I just wanted to perhaps illustrate those points with a student story. Her name is Melissa Lampro. She dropped out of school in the eighth grade. She never went back to school after that. At the age of 32, she was cleaning houses and raising her family, and she knew that her options were really, really limited. She made the very brave choice of getting her GED, and then after her GED, she came to Portland Community College. She's a full-time student taking classes online in the evenings and on the weekends, and works 30 hours a week, volunteers, and raises her two kids, one of which needs regular medical care. Managing all of this, she's earned a 4.0 grade point average and is on her way to earning her degree in business administration. So this is what the community colleges really are all about. And, faculty, staff, and administrators are attracted to this work because basically we're in the business of changing lives. And it's a very labor-intensive business, but we know that students don't care how much we know until they know how much we care and can develop that relationship in order to help students to be successful. I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that we're doing in order to help our students to avoid debt, to complete college, to be successful, and to get into living wage careers that help their families and their communities. One is, Ben mentioned the food insecurity. So our student leaders actually banded together and are using student activity fees to fund food pantries on our campuses. And it's embarrassing, as you can imagine, it's embarrassing to ask for food. And so the students are very sensitive in how they've been able to set it up, and they get the word out. And, students come and they pick it up for their friends, and so that they can provide that to their students. We have, speaking of textbooks, we have an open educational resource project that we're funding, and we believe that we are going to save students an incredible amount of money. Our estimates initially are $1 million on a particular course that textbooks are very expensive for. And so we have funded this initiative internally, and we're moving forward with it, and we will be monitoring it. The other area that we're looking at is integration of federal benefits. The six federal agencies came together and they issued a joint letter to states around how federal benefits can be integrated in order to foster greater college completion for low-income residents and recipients. They include Pell, SNAP, which is food stamps, education, and training dollars, as well as TANF, work-study, TANF education and training, HUD, Section 8 housing vouchers, and the American Opportunity Tax Credit. So there are ways that states can align their policy framework that makes it more conducive for recipients to meet their unmet need through these integrated federal benefits and be more likely to complete college. And by doing that, they are obviously going to not be dependent on these federal benefits, because what better way to establish escape velocity out of poverty than through education and training. So we're very pleased to be working with OCCA and PCC to begin to look at this and pilot this, how this could be promoted. So one quick example is a program that we're engaged with called SNAP 5050. It's a partnership, innovative partnership with DHS, and the 5050 program basically, for every dollar a community college provides to the education and training of a food stamp recipient, USDA provides a 50-cent reimbursement or rebate. That extends the ability to reach more food stamp recipients to help them move out of poverty through what we call a career pathway approach. And our career pathway programs have a very strong set of outcomes in terms of progression and completion. And so, and also, these are very diverse programs in terms of helping low-income communities of color to move out of poverty through education and training. So those are just a few of the examples of what we're doing at PCC in partnership with OCCA and others.
Thank you for your testimony. We are running out of time. I want to give Dr. Fuller a moment, but I'll comment that we, in our workforce development part of this committee, will be looking next week at a similar activity of how do we better align the number of different agencies that are using a variety of benefits or providing a variety of benefits. So we're on the same track, so we should compare notes at some point. But that'd be great. So thank you for that.
Yeah.
And we do, I'm supposed to let them out at 4:45. I no pressure, but
I've seen more pressure than that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to be here. My name is Rex Fuller. I'm the president of Western Oregon University, and I'm also chair of the Oregon Council of University Presidents, and I'm here representing that group as well. Ben, I don't know if you can drive the slides for me, but we'll go through a number of these very quickly. If you'll go to the third slide, this is a repeat of what Executive Director Cannon put up a moment ago. The slides in red, though, are worth pulling out in the sense of those are the states that are nearby, the Western undergraduate exchange states that oftentimes look at enrollment within Oregon as well. So we draw students from the WUI states, as they're called. And that gives you more indication of, again, the relative position of Oregon vis-a-vis the states that are neighboring us as well. Ben has some slides related to that as well. As a beginning point, I want to stress the fact that all three of us are here today to talk about affordability. What I say on my campus is access must have affordability to create opportunity. Without the ability for families to put together a financial package, that access and acceptance is a hollow promise. And so affordability is a key measure for our conversation today that we're all committed to. And I would say the best policy is low tuition. And I'm an economist by background, and as was pointed out by Executive Director Cannon. The sad history of the last 50 years is a gradual shift of who pays for college from states to families and students through tuition. And that trend was reversed, thankfully, a bit in 15-17. We're thankful for that investment. But yet we also face challenges going forward if we're going to keep tuition at reasonable rates going forward. The slides we have oftentimes overlap with what you've seen from the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. So I'll not comment on those. And I want to highlight two programs, two universities, my university, Western Oregon University, and Oregon State University, on programs we haven't talked about. I would say, in terms of the questions that have been asked and answered thus far, universities also engage in financial aid literacy efforts. We have TRIO programs that wrap around first-gen efforts. I'm pleased to report that our program on student enrichment program, which wraps around first-gen and low-income students, we have a higher retention rate than our general population because of that intervention. And those partnerships with programs such as the Chaser Chavez Academy help families understand that college is affordable if they are able to access some of the assistance that's available to them. But if you could go to the slide that highlights Western, Ben. Western Tuition Promise. Since 2007, Western has engaged in a, sort of a structured tuition approach that allows families to essentially identify a fixed mortgage in the sense of fixed payment. And we've been doing that since 2007, so families and students can lock in a tuition rate for the entire 4 years. That creates certainty, their ability to then finance their future going forward. And about a third of our students, even to this day, pick that program. In that means, in terms of our student body population, about over time, roughly 40% of our students are enrolled on that at any given time. It creates certainty for families. There's a premium charged for that that program. And the risk to the university, of course, then is if we have misgauged the conditions of the economy, we have a bit of risk exposed to us as we think about changing tuition, especially in a climate of rising tuition. Having said that, we are committed to doing that going forward because we believe it's an active program that draws interest. And we find that actually families from all income levels are gravitating to this program. It's not simply those that might be most affluent. Rather, we find that oftentimes those around median incomes of $50,000 oftentimes opt for this because it creates that certainty around what they can afford going forward, and they're willing to make that investment in their son or daughter. So that's an important program that we've engaged in. I quickly give you a sense of how we also identify institutional aid. Last year, for example, we increased tuition nominally 3%, but for those with earned family contributions of zero, we froze tuition. So we ran a dual strategy in that program identifies how we split the two, the different scholarships, work study, loans, grants among the students that we have. Oregon State has a highlighted slide here, identifies the number of students they have. 71% of those students are dependent and not independent, and they have about 18,500 students from Oregon, so heavily Oregonian as well. Their highlight is the Bridge to Success program, 2025, and it identifies ways in which they can put institutional aid in the pockets of those students who are most needy. There's $7.5 million of institutional aid provided in the most recent completed fiscal year. And 42% of that money went to first-gen students, 40% went to minorities, and 21% went to legacy students who were qualified by income. And so you see that they're targeting dollars, $7.5 million of that $37 million, to those who are most needy going forward. The good news here is they find that students who participate in that program are retained at a higher rate, just as our program finds that as well, and that leads to graduation. I think the one thing that you'll hear from all of us is it's about seeing our students be accepted, find an affordable pathway, and then finishing, earning a degree so that they can move forward and move on to that next step in their career or further education. And that's really what higher education is refocused itself on in terms of making sure the outcomes are what the Oregonians and the citizens of the state of Oregon want to see for their own children, but also for the investment we need if we're going to close the educational attainment gap. I will close by saying the work we have to do is most acute for low-income and underrepresented minorities, where the current baccalaureate holding rate for those two populations is less than 10% compared to about 30% for the majority white, and our goal is 40%. And there's a study by Norwest, EcoNorwest, which says if we close that educational attainment gap in 2003, there'd be $2 billion more in state domestic product every year if everyone were earning at that higher rate. That's the ROI on education that we need to return to.
If you can put your hands on that,
actually, it's a report that I got at the HEC website, so we can, I'm sure we can send that forward to you. Thank it was you. Done in March of 2015. But again, I know we're running short on time. It's a pleasure to be here and share these things with you. I appreciate your support of higher education going forward and the investments you're making in our citizens.
Thank you. Thank you all three for being here. I feel like we're rushing you just a little bit. I don't really want to encourage any more questions right now.
I'm sitting on
I think
my
you can tell there's a great interest in this subject, and that you know, we'll see what we can do, possibly schedule a part two. So if you have questions that were unanswered or things that come up that would help, please send those to Laura, and we'll kind of generate a list.
Great, thank
you. See what else we need to know. But this is a really good good start for this committee, and we appreciate your work. And who knows, we may come up with additional bills, but I don't know if that's
great, thank
I don't know
you.
If that's what you want necessarily, but all right. Thank you again. Anything else for the good of the order? Okay, I am closing this informational order hearing, and I'm closing a meeting of the House Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee. Thank you, Ed and Workforce Development Committee.